and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're examining the future of China and its position as a developing nation. Today's presenter is Damian Ma, a political analyst and author of the book In Line Behind a Billion People, How Scarcity Will Define China's Ascent in the Next Decade. This talk was titled China as Number One, So What? And examines how far China has developed over the last 35 years and where they are headed now. This event took place on April 28th at the Hilton Hotel and was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. We should note that Mr. Ma refers frequently to a slideshow presentation that you can find at the Addressing Alaskans page at alaskapublic.org. Dr. Paul Dunscombe, chair of the History Department at the University of Alaska Anchorage, provides the introduction.
Thank you all for joining us today. Long-time members of the Alaska World Affairs Council will know that China has had a long-standing presence in our programming. Indeed, as part of an ongoing project to preserve our history, I have learned that a group from the World Affairs Council was among the first to travel to China after President Nixon's announcement of his intention to travel to Beijing in 1971. Now, I'm still digging deeper into this story, and we'll be very happy to share it with you once we've gotten it together. But for now, let us enjoy the continuation of a World Affairs Council tradition with today's speaker, Damian Ma. Damian Ma is fellow and associate director of the think tank at the Paulson Institute, focused on investment and policy programs. He also currently serves as adjunct lecturer at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. He is co-author of the book, In Line Behind a Billion People, How Scarcity Will Define China's Ascent in the Next Decade. Also has produced an edition of The Economics of Air Pollution in China by Ma Jun, the chief economist of the Chinese Central Bank. Damian Ma served as lead China and Mongolia analyst at the political risk research and advisory firm, the Eurasia Group. Prior to joining Eurasia Group, he was manager of publications at the U.S.-China Business Council in Washington, D.C. He also worked in public relations in the public relations firm H-Line Ogilvy in Beijing, where he served major multinational clients. In addition to his wide range of publications, Damian Ma has appeared on a range of broadcast media, such as The Charlie Rose Show, the BBC, NPR, and CNBC. He also served as an adjunct instructor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. He is a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations and was named one of the 99 under 33 foreign policy leaders in 2012 by the Young Professionals in Foreign Policy. Needless to say, he also speaks fluent Mandarin Chinese. Today, to speak to us on the topic China as number one, so what? Please join me in welcoming Damian Ma.
Well, good afternoon, and I am delighted to be here, not least because this is my first time to Alaska, and so I've always wanted to come to the 49th state, and I never got a chance until I got an invitation from the Alaska World Affairs Council, so I jumped at it, and after we landed yesterday, since I've never been here, we took a little drive out to Portage. And I was joking that we were following in President Xi Jinping's footsteps. And I know you guys got a very surprise VIP visit from the Chinese president, which was quite something that even caught me by surprise. But I understand why he did it, and we can go into that a little bit in the Q&A. But which is all that is to say that it's probably a terrific time to be talking about China, although, you know, from where I sit, there's never a bad time to be talking about China, but because we're 2 weeks after the president's visit, it's even better. So ostensibly, part of my talk is supposed to be about the book that I published a few years ago, but I'm always wary to kind of just give a book talk because I always think, well, you know, you can always read the book. So the way I'm gonna approach my talk is really weave the themes of my book throughout the talk, but it's gonna be a little bit different. It's going to be more current and it's going to be focused on some other issues, especially some of the latest developments in China. And ultimately, what I wanted to talk about, as the title implies, China as number one, this was essentially a riff off of a pretty influential book. Some of you may know this book, Japan as Number One. that was published by a Harvard scholar in the late 80s or early 90s. And that was an earnest, serious book that at the time, Japan was very competitive. There was a lot of concern and fear in this country, at least, that Japan was going to not only catch up, but also surpass the United States in a lot of different areas, particularly in terms of economics. And so that obviously turned out to not be the case. Japan stagnated since the mid-1990s and hasn't really recovered since then. So I have a little bit twist on that, and hence the subtitle, So What? It's in part satirical, in part earnest. It's both sort of so what and also I will tell you so what, hopefully. But what I will focus on is two overarching ideas. Talking about China can be complicated because it's a very complex and diverse economy and country, obviously. So that, needless to say, it's always hard to kind of get the nuances. So I'm going to do my best to put in the nuances, but at the same time, hopefully simplify a little bit with two overarching concepts that I hope people in the room will leave today with. And they kind of center around the idea of two traps. One is an economic trap, one is a geopolitical trap. And I'll go into them specifically later on. But to understand that, we first have to have some context of where China has been and where it is today before we can think about where it's going. And this is where I will begin. On the economic side, we all know China is basically a virtually unstoppable colossus for the last 20, 30 years. Just looking at the purple line from the World Bank, if China were a stock and you put your money in China in 1979, right after it opened up by Deng Xiaoping, you would have made a lot of money because it would have been a continuous appreciation of your stock price if China were a stock. It's basically managed the blue line, although it's volatile, it's averaged about 9 to 10% growth for about 30 years. Absolutely unprecedented in recent economic history. The yellow bar is a little bit high because of the conversion rate on PPP. I won't go into the details, but basically, in real terms, China is now about 13 to 14% of the global economy. The United States has been holding steady at about 23, 24%. So the world's two largest economies is about 40% of global output. It's enormous. Whatever these two countries do will have ripple effects across the global economy. And think about it in a different way. The rise of China is really an issue of, is really the story of convergence, global economic convergence, or what Fareeza Kara has called rise of the rest. This is not just China, it's what, you know, some people have called the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, and India. Russia's not on here, Brazil and India are. They obviously have not performed as well as China has. And in fact, if you ask me today, BRIC would not exist if it were not for China. A lot of Brazilian and Indian growth was actually tied to China growth. And I'll go into that why a little bit later on. So when it comes to the acronym BRIC, the C is much larger than the other BRIs, right? So this is an issue of convergence. China is now at about 60% of the US GDP. And we all know China is an export powerhouse. How many people here own something made in China? I assume everyone does. That is probably the closest way in which your average American or average anybody in the world interacts with the Chinese economy personally. But I just wanted to put this up because it shows how staggering the Chinese export powerhouse really is, even relative to the United States. It's essentially the total export volume or value is about Japan plus Germany. It's enormous. This is something that we're having a problem with right now politically in this country and in terms of U.S.-China trade. I'll go into that a little bit later when I talk about U.S.-China. But I just wanted to show you, again, why China truly matters in terms of its global weight, in terms of its output, in terms of just the amount of stuff that ascends around the world and the supply chains that are now being built in the Chinese economy. However, and there's always a however, the Chinese economy is no longer the kind of, is no longer sprinting. It's really slowed down to a jog. And you can see, although 2014 is a little bit dated, I wanted to show you the peak. The Chinese economy, the growth really peaked in 2007, before the financial crisis. it hit a peak about 14%, which is absolutely enormous. And it's really slowed down till about 6.5% today, which is still enviable by most metrics, by most developing country metrics. No other developing country is really growing that fast. And in this country, we're growing about 2.5%. So even 6.5% is very respectable. But for China, that is really like a jog rather than a sprint. And this is also why the core theme of my book really is the future. The future for China is really not going to be defined by growth anymore. It's going to be defined by this idea of scarcity, which I will again talk about a little bit about what it is, how it manifests itself, and why I chose to look at China that particular way. Okay, now, as I said, I wanted to organize this talk around two overarching ideas. One is the economic trap, and this is the middle income trap. For those of you who are not familiar with this particular concept, it is somewhat debated in the economic community, but basically there is a body of evidence that suggests it is pretty easy, if you're a poor, low-income country, it's easy to get to sort of middle income or high middle income. Which is the high middle income is about $15,000 per capita GDP. But it's extraordinarily hard to go from middle income to advanced, wealthy, high income like the United States, Japan, and other Western developed countries. And the World Bank actually did a very interesting study a few years ago where they categorized people in this chart, although the chart's pulled from The Economist, this TikTok chart. If you can see, primarily, the middle center square is still middle income, high income. That's still predominantly a lot of the countries. They're kind of there, and they haven't made the move up to the top. And in fact, since 1960, only 13, if you think about that, there are about 190 plus countries in the world. Less than 10% have made the jump from middle income to high income. And five of those 13 that have made it happen to be the so-called Asian tigers, or East Asian economies: Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and so on. And you know, countries like Brazil, even though they're part of the BRICS grouping, they have not made the leap from middle income to high income. So there's this hypothesis that countries seem to get stuck in this range of 8,000 to 15,000 per capita GDP, and it's really hard to rejigger your economy to become a $20,000, $40,000, or in our case, $55,000 per capita GDP wealthy country. And why does this matter to China? Well, $8,000. Some of you can probably guess what that $80,000 stands for. That is about roughly the current per capita GDP of China. China is a typical middle-income country. It might be slightly higher now, but it's basically about $8,000. So China is in the middle of this so-called middle-income trap. It is smack dab in it, and it needs to figure out a way out. And that is essentially what I'm going to talk about in terms of the challenges for China, how it gets out of this trap, what it needs to do, and what are some of the constraints on China to achieve its goals. And before I get there, though, does anybody know who else is an $8,000 per capita GDP? Just random guess. Shout out anything you may think about. Russia? Russia is actually a little bit higher. Brazil is also a little bit higher. So one country is Colombia, okay? The reason I juxtapose that is, again, for a question and a thought for later is anyone asking Colombia to be a global leader? Is anyone asking Colombia to shoulder global responsibilities or project global power? No one is, certainly not the United States, yet they are at the same per capita GDP income level as China. The point here is China is an outlier. China's global footprint is so big that it's become influential even before it's wealthy. And it's being asked to do things that other countries are not asked to do. So in some sense, I sympathize because it is a tough position to be in. Okay, and I'll kind of talk about why that matters later, but I just wanted to make sure that you understand that there's a perceptual difference between how others perceive China and how they perceive themselves in terms of what they are prepared to do and the amount of power they're willing to project around the world. How does China intend to avoid the middle or escape the middle income trap? Well, politically, officially, they have these two macro quantitative targets. If you know anything about the Chinese political system, they love targets. their growth targets, their job targets, their all kinds of targets. So these are political goals. And let me explain what the two 100 years goals mean. It's been around for a while. What it means is by 2020, actually roughly 2020, 2021, is China is basically going to lay the groundwork to basically be able to escape the middle income trap. Okay, it's going to go from sort of smack dab in the middle income to basically high middle income. Why 2020 or 2021? Well, this is 100 years from the founding of the Communist Party of China. So they set out a goal that they decided 100 years from the founding of the Communist Party of China, they were going to basically become a moderately prosperous country. That's tied to a specific GDP, per capita GDP idea. And high-income country, why 2049? High-income meaning they have succeeded in eluding the trap. Well, 2049, that's 100 years from when the modern Chinese Republic was founded under Mao Zedong in 1949, okay? So let's cast aside the 2049 goal for a while because that's, you know, 30 years down the line. But just to get to its 2020, kind of GDP speaking, it implies an average annual growth of 6.5%. This is why China has these targets. Because if the political goal is to be a moderately prosperous country by 2020, well, then the actual quantitative numbers has to match the political aspiration, even though the economic fundamentals may not actually match the actual political aspiration, right? So these are kind of the macro targets, how does China get out of this? I want to talk about three buckets. One is financial capital. I'll explain what that is. Human capital, meaning the labor market, and social capital, and how these things have changed, and what China needs to do to really go from a middle income to a high income country. Let me start with financial capital first. And by the way, no one believes that China can simply grow its way out of these problems, right? So they must reform. Not to get into too many details, but China launched a massive reform agenda in 2013 when the current president, President Xi, came to power. And they have about 2022 to finish this reform program. And guess what? That is just aligning with their 2021 goal of moderately prosperous country. So they plan all this out. Basically, President Xi wants to leave a legacy of putting the Chinese economy on a stable footing that is about to go from middle to high income. That would be his major political legacy. So, what does reform mean? Well, here's what the Chinese growth looks like. I want to illustrate with this picture because I think it brings to sharp relief what it is, how China has succeeded so far. Anybody here has ever been to Shanghai? Back in 1987, anybody? No? So some people have. Okay, well, so if you looked out east, this is the major river that cuts through the middle of the city, that bifurcates the city. You're looking east, it's mostly swamps, farmland, and very, you know, low rises, not much there, 1987. So this is the iconic skyline you see today of Shanghai that you see everywhere. That took about a generation to do, right? And the reason I show you that, because I like to hear people go, whoa, you know, but secondly, there's an actual point, which is that the point here is it's not just Shanghai. It's not just Beijing. It's a lot of hundreds and hundreds of Chinese cities all across the nation over that period from about the late 80s to about now has embarked on this massive expansion and growth and infrastructure. The conventional wisdom is that China is an export-dependent economy. That's actually not true. If you look at the actual contributions to the Chinese economy, China is really an investment-driven, investment-dependent economy. What do they invest in? Well, they invest in things like property. Property is 16% of the Chinese economy. It's huge. So anytime there's volatility in a Chinese property market, the economic policymakers get very nervous because that could lead to a serious contraction of the Chinese economy and it affects a lot of other upstream and downstream industries. So the Chinese just can't seem to get enough of property, whether it's residential or commercial. And it's a huge, huge global sector. If you think about 16% of an $11 trillion economy is enormous. And they invest in huge public goods infrastructure like these sleek new high-speed rails. I wish we have some high-speed rail in this country, but we do not. But China will soon, by 2020, have the world's largest high-speed rail network. These are trains that go at about 250 miles an hour. I take it all the time now to go from Beijing to Shanghai. It beats flying. That rail used to take about 14 hours on the slow train. Now it's 5 hours. So I leave Beijing by 7, and I get to Shanghai by lunch. So it's a tremendous project. There were a lot of detractors about whether it was costly or cost effective. Nonetheless, it's really generated new economic dynamism along the routes. But these things cost a lot of money, and they're far from done. Now, all that infrastructure, all those housing, it requires a lot of inputs. So, again, these three charts to me are also quite staggering. 50% of steel production now of the world comes from China, okay? More than 50% of cement comes from China, and basically about 50% of aluminum comes from China, all right? And I don't have this figure up here, but the most incredible statistic I heard recently was that I believe it was roughly between 2011 and 2013, China consumed more cement in those 2 years than the United States did in the entire 20th century, okay? Which makes sense if you think about it. Our building boom was really ended around 1950s and 1960s. So it was about a 30, 40 year building boom in the United States. But China, because of its economic stimulus, this leads to some trade problems, other overcapacity, overinvestment problems. But this is what I mean by investment-driven economy. Not an export, but an investment-driven economy. What do, these industries, they also need additional upstream inputs, things like iron ore. You can't make steel without iron ore. And this is where one manifestation of scarcity comes in. China doesn't have iron ore. China doesn't not have high quality iron ore to actually smelt and make steel with. So they got to import all of this. And this again is incredible because if you look at between 2000 and 2010, virtually the entire growth in iron ore demand around the world was all because of China. That's it. No other country mattered. It was because of China, because of the steel sector, because of the building boom. All those things are interlinked. And who benefited from this particular growth model? Well, Australia, Brazil, all the big exporters of these types of commodities, right? So this was what, if you were an investor, they would call it a commodity super cycle. And that super cycle was absolutely propelled by the type of growth that China had, this investment-intensive growth. Now, here's some downside. Well, how do you power an economy that was chugging all these resources, trying to support all these heavy industries? Well, China has not a lot of natural resource endowments, unlike Alaska. China does not have a lot of oil. China does not have a lot of gas. China is a net oil importer. China is also about to become a natural gas importer. The only thing it has in abundance is this yellow bar, coal. So, as you can see, even relative to other developing countries, Russia and Brazil, also fellow BRIC countries, China is a complete outlier when it comes to coal. Okay, China is a coal-based economy. It's about 70% driven by coal. This is obviously going to lead to some problems, as some of you have, I'm sure, read or seen on the news. But again, I want to bring it to sort of sharper relief by, again, giving you some more granular data. Anybody know what, anybody been to this province called Hebei? Oh yeah? Okay, so Hebei, for those of you who don't know, is the neighboring province of the Chinese capital, Beijing. So the whited out part is where Beijing would be. So what does Hebei have in common with the European Union? Well, Hebei alone in 2012 produced as much steel as the entire European Union combined in that one single province, okay? It's about twice U.S. production, just in that single province. It's like Pittsburgh on steroids. Okay, so that's what Hebei really is. And the local official there, I believe this was a quote from a local governor who basically said, if China was the number one steel producer, the province itself would be number two producer in the world, and that specific city on the East Coast, it would be number three in the world, just that city alone in terms of steel output. Okay. This is the scale we're talking about. Now, why does this matter? Well, I have to give credit to one of my friends. He was an expat in China for about 10 years, and he used to live in downtown Beijing. And he took this photo, credit to him, on a very nice blue sky, perfect visibility day. This is central Beijing. This is the new financial district, central business district. He took that, and he took the same photo on an air apocalypse day outside his window. This is what air pollution can look like in China, in Beijing. Okay, so Beijing is next to Hebei. Now I think you guys are making the connection, right? Steel town, steel province next to Beijing, coal-based economy. So this is visibility was maybe 5 or 10 feet that day. It's become, and they've had numerous days like this, obviously. This was the Beijing Capital Airport just 2 years ago. They couldn't take off because the pollution was so bad. So it is starting to having an economic impact because when flights can't go, people can't get to their destinations, businesses slow down, right? And this is the cost of the current economic growth model. This is also one of the more economic cost of the growth model is the continuing piling up of a domestic debt and leverage. This is something I'm sure you've read in the financial presses. It's not quite the crisis point that people make it out to be, but it's clearly not sustainable. You can't have the rate of debt growing faster than GDP. That's just not going to work for any number of years, and you're no longer going to be able to grow out of your debt. The key point here is to know that a lot of the debt is actually in the corporate sector, not in households. So China's probably not going to face kind of a mortgage crisis that we did in this country in terms of a personal household debt. But it's really about the companies, and within those companies, it's really the state assets, the state companies, that are the huge problem. They're just littered with zombie firms that are basically insolvent, but they're kept alive politically because they support local jobs. That's where all the debt is coming from. Okay, so China needs to transition. Okay, China needs to transition, and there are two big transitions. One is going from kind of an investment-driven model to a consumption-driven model, okay? And the other transition is to go from an emphasis on quantity, meaning GDP targets, to kind of the quality, where growth is coming from. So investment to consumption and quantity to quality. And this, to me, resembles what could potentially happen when China becomes a more consumption-driven economy, okay? China's obviously one of the biggest pork-consuming nations in the world, by far. It consumes about 50% of the world's coal, also consumes about 50% of the world's pork and pigs, okay? Coal supplies power plants. What supplies pigs? Well, corn, soybeans, agricultural commodities. What does the United States have a lot of? Agricultural commodities. So this is one way in which the U.S. economy is very complementary to the Chinese economy if China makes that transition to a more consumption-driven economy. And not to mention that China has a lot of food safety problems and they have small-scale hog farmers that don't actually make sense in terms of the consumption patterns that are about to increase. This may seem like sort of mundane stuff, but it's important when you think about food supply globally, vis-a-vis other sets of commodities. So this is one particular manifestation of what would happen, what could potentially happen if China were to switch or successfully rebalance its economy from investment to consumption. And the other is that China no longer wants to be the factory of the world. The only proven way so far to get out of the middle income trap is to become a much more highly efficient economy. You don't stop investing, but that investment has to be more efficient, and you have to be a much more innovative economy. So I want to show you this because most people have either probably a an iPhone or an Android. Well, where is the value for China in that pie chart? It doesn't exist. China is inputted as a cost of labor. So China doesn't get much at all from just assembling the iPhone. It says made in China, right? But it says designed in Cupertino, okay? The new Chinese economy wants to say designed in China and made somewhere else. That's what China wants to do. That's the innovation game. And so assembling iPhones is absolutely not very beneficial to the Chinese economy. It's a very razor-thin margins. So they want to be able to be in the left side of the smile curve and the right side of the smile curve, where there's much higher value added. Right now they're in the bottom in the manufacturing. They need to climb on both ends of the curve. This is a famous curve concept that was invented by a Taiwanese company Acer Computers, which has done very well in terms of going up the curve. And they're now one of the most competitive computer brands in terms of PC. So China needs to become a more innovative economy. And how do you become a more innovative economy? Well, you need human capital. You need to make sure that your labor market supports your broader economic desires to rebalance the economy. And this is also why China has to move from manufacturing and exports and investment to innovation, because, again, one of the themes in my book about scarcity is that China is just simply running out of younger workers. If 18-year-olds entering the workforce is a proxy for future labor force, they're not going to get as many workers. So the day of the sort of the so-called China price, cheap pricing, is no longer going to happen. Within the last 2 or 3 years alone, labor wages in a lot of the manufacturing provinces have been up 25-30%. Sometimes even 40% at the factory level. So China is no longer that cheap of a place to make your socks, to make your shoes, or to make these kind of white goods. And China doesn't want to be. China wants to exit that business, not because there's a political aspiration, but because the labor market no longer will support that. And so they need to train more talented, highly educated, white collar workers to kind of help steer the ship towards a new economy.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing from political analyst Damian Ma and his talk, China as Number One, So What? This event was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council at the Hilton Hotel on April 28th. We return now to the program, and if you'd like to see the slideshow that he refers to during his presentation, you can find that at the webpage for today's show at alaskapublic.org.
The final thing I want to talk about, so I talked about human capital, that was the labor market, financial capital, investment needs to be more efficient and targeted at the right things, and the last piece is social capital. What do I mean by social capital? I'll give you a few seconds to read this definition by famous political theorist Douglas North. Essentially, to boil it down, it's a set of incentives, norms, and systems that would create the broader environment for innovation, for this transition. There's a lot of theories from economists and political scientists that institutions matter a lot in sort of shifting a system away from a particular growth model. And so this is kind of a standard definition of it, but I wanted to illustrate with another pretty, I think, stark example of why institutions probably matters. It's not the end all be all, but it matters a lot. North Korea has been on everyone's minds. Well, that's a picture of the Korean Peninsula. Some very smart person decided to look at light density between North and South Dakota, North and South Korea. And light intensity can be a proxy for economic activity. Obviously, if you have your lights on, you're probably doing some sort of economic activity rather than dark. So that's 1992 on the left, and that's 2008 on the right. If you look at Pyongyang, which is the capital of North Korea, it's actually gotten dimmer, right? But Seoul and everywhere else in South Korea has gotten brighter, meaning South Korea has prospered a lot more in those intervening years, whereas if you believe this kind of data, North Korea has probably regressed. Now, this division was arbitrary, the 37th parallel. It was an arbitrary division because of the conclusion of a war. They're Korean people, ethnically, culturally, socially. They're the same people. So what is the difference? Korea, Communist Party, China also Communist Party, but what's the difference? Maybe it's a set of institutions that North Korea just doesn't have, that South Korea has, that China has adapted in some way more successfully than the others. Okay, so this is where institutions having sort of good enough property rights, protection of intellectual property, certain sets of legal norms where you're not worried about your assets being stripped away by the government arbitrarily, these types of incentives and institutions do matter for economic growth. And that will matter even more for China going forward if it wants to become a more innovative and an efficient economy to really escape the middle income trap. Now, that ends my riff on the economic dimensions of the trap. Here's the second part, and I'll go through this quickly, and this ties directly to U.S.-China relations. There's this idea propounded by a Harvard scholar, and in fact they have an entire project dedicated to the idea of the Thucydides trap. And Thucydides was a famous Greek historian that hypothesized during the Peloponnesian War way back in 5th century BC, many, many, many years ago, I don't remember the exact date, before my time, that basically the war was fought between Sparta and Athens. And he hypothesized that because Sparta was terrified and afraid of being dethroned by Athens, that that inevitably led to war. So he basically went through this huge historical record case study project, and he found that so far it doesn't look like the historical record is very good in terms of when a rising power starts to challenge an established power and the result of that. He argues that 12 of the 16 cases in his database has led to war, some sort of war, limited or all-out confrontation. Four cases have not. Obviously, when the United States surpassed UK, that I think is a pretty obvious one to explain. But whether you buy this or not, and I tend to kind of disagree with this hypothesis, but it has captured the minds of Chinese policymakers and U.S. policymakers. Whether this is real or not, they think about it, because whether you believe there is an actual trap, there is certainly a transition going on right now in the world. And it is predominantly between the United States and China. And this is a transition not like what we had with the Soviet Union back in the 1950s. We're not in any kind of a Cold War scenario, but still, there is clearly some sort of transition going on. And obviously, I would argue, too, that if you see the last three cases, there was no war. Three in a row. Now, why is that? It was the dawning of the nuclear age. We dropped bombs on Japan, and that was the only time nuclear bombs have been used. And so you had, could the three no war cases be explained by the fact that the nuclear deterrent is very effective? I don't know. But in any event, I want to bring this up because this does capture the mind of people sitting in Beijing and people sitting in Washington, D.C., and how we deal with this U.S.-China relationship is going to be ever more important. And let me just quickly say why it is important and how we have managed it today. This is an interesting a graph that I like to show because it shows both the trade relationship, the bilateral trade relationship that we had with China since the 1980s, and I've overlaid it with some of the key political crises between our two countries. Any single one of those could have led to probably fairly serious confrontation, but they did not. Now, why is that? I would argue it's because economic linkages have been our strongest anchor in the bilateral relationship. If we did not have this trade relationship, about a $600 billion trade relationship, any one of those political crises, whether it's Taiwan, Tiananmen Square, Taiwan Strait crisis in the 1990s under Bill Clinton, the EP3 collision under George Bush Jr., and all those things could have really soured the relationship in a fundamental way, but they did not. And right now we're at a kind of inflection point where this bilateral trade relationship is becoming contested in D.C. a lot more, right? Under the current administration. So that's a very interesting point to watch, that what if this trade relationship goes, do we still have some kind of anchor to bind the two countries? Let's remember, when Nixon first opened up China, or when Nixon first went to China, he opened up to China because for a geopolitical rationale. It was to counter, back then, the Soviet threat. Both China and the United States felt the Russians were more threatening than they were to each other. So there was the alliance of conveniences. But that geopolitical rationale is gone. It no longer exists. So there is no overarching rationale geopolitically for US and China, but there is the economic side. There is the people-to-people side. You've all seen a lot of Chinese students come to this country that is, I think, a huge positive for the relationship. And I think if you were to ask me, the future of U.S.-China relationship is not going to be about trade. It's going to be about investment, particularly Chinese direct investment in this country, because investment really binds the two countries together much more than trade. Trade is more intangible. Your view of trade is just shipping containers coming into ports. But when you're talking about investments, you're dealing with actual people, investors, face-to-face, projects, local communities, so on and so on. And this is what I mean why trade is becoming more contentious. This was an economics paper by three authors coming out of UC San Diego. This paper, more than anything, really drove the trade debate in this political cycle. They basically said they found evidence that China's role in the World Trade Organization has led to millions of job losses in the United States, particularly in the Rust Belt. This is the first big economic paper that's found pretty substantial evidence. It's not because of Mexico, it's not because of Canada, but China alone. In fact, the paper itself was called China Shock, right? So the China Shock was so big purely because of China's size and the way it structured its economy, it had a more significant damage at the local level job creation or job loss than a lot of the other free trade. So this paper alone drove a lot of the current thinking and the debate around what should we do with trade, in particular against China. So there are a lot of uncertainties and moving pieces there. And so I think, you know, if you were to ask me what to do or how to think about the U.S.-China relationship, I don't come from a national security background, but when it comes from an economic bottom-up perspective, we really got to try to find what is that new anchor. Because nothing's really guaranteed in international relations. And we all know that there's a lot of potential volatilities in the geopolitical arena. And so what can we do if we were to avoid the Thucydides trap, whether you buy that notion or not? If we were to avoid it, what do we need to do as a country, as both countries, to kind of stabilize this relationship 40 years after it was formalized, essentially. And I hate to leave on a kind of a downer, sour note, but this is something that I think about a lot in my day job, that I constantly try to work toward and try to figure out ways in which not necessarily find a more overarching rationale, but to figure out how we can anchor this relationship again so that the next 40 years does not become a more contentious Cold War-like scenario between our two countries. 40% of global economy. We should not want to expect volatility between these two countries. But we need to think really hard about what we need to do, not just as individual Americans, and also at the policy level. Thank you very much, and I'm open to any questions you have.
Thank you very much. If we compare the two countries, China and the United States, how do the economies compare in terms of assets devoted to military expenditures? And similarly, how do the two economies compare with assets devoted to what we might call entitlement programs for the aged, the poor, children, things like that?
Great question. On the first question, China is now the second largest spender on their military in the world. Its numbers are hard to figure out because the Chinese don't count military spending the same way we do. But most analysts who really study that particular aspect would say that China is probably spending about roughly around $200 billion a year on their military. And they are certainly much more capable than they were just 5 years ago, or even 10 or 5 years ago. I'll tell you what really drove China's major military modernization program was, in fact, part of it was the Gulf War. So a lot of Chinese leaders back then looked at how high tech the U.S. military was, and in the Gulf War, and that got them quite nervous about their own backwardness and their own and how far behind they were. So they invested since the 1990s to develop many more capabilities, both in terms of conventional and also cyber capabilities. They just launched their second aircraft carrier, completely domestically made. So they're now one of the few countries in the world who can make their own aircraft carriers. So we can talk about Chinese capabilities a lot, but to me, it's really always about capability plus intent. You know, what do they intend to do with that capability? How do they intend to behave in the Asia-Pacific region? And what do they want that military for? Are they going to deploy it specifically against the United States? On the second point, on social welfare, education, pensions, that is one major dimension of scarcity that I talk about in my book. So a lot of the investment-driven model really took a lot of the money away from pensions, education, welfare, because those fiscal budgets are always controlled at the local level. So there was a lot of corruption in the local level where they just took that money that were meant for pensions and put it into the next bridge or into the next road. So a lot of the local pension systems, for example, are sitting empty in China, and that's a huge, huge problem. As many of you probably have heard, China's getting older faster than they anticipated. So they're going to hit a potential demographic crisis if they can't support a lot of these, a lot of the elderly population. So that is something they're clearly focused on.
Thank you very much. It's the end of the day, you're home, you turn on your television set, President Trump is talking about China. What do you think?
I just figure he's probably tweeting more about China than he's talking about China, right? What do I think? I've tried to avoid reading his tweets lately, so I am on Twitter. So although it's hard to avoid what he says on China, I guess I was a bit more concerned when he first came into office and he started, obviously he took the phone call with the president of Taiwan, and that was... Certainly not necessarily the typical protocol. Certainly the first phone call is usually not to the Taiwanese president. And fortunately, I think he got some good advice, and I think this issue has been managed pretty well. Although for a while, I was a little concerned that the Chinese might react pretty badly, and that could have been a much worse outcome than it has turned out to be. So I don't have a very clear view yet, and in fact, in part because I personally don't quite know exactly what his China policy may or may not be, so I think it's a lot of wait and see. And I do know that he is clearly very focused on North Korea, and he's been talking to the president of China a lot on North Korea. But whether that comes out to anything, that's very, very hard to say.
So it seems like these the wealthiest parts of China also happen to be the farthest away from Beijing. Think Shenzhen, which is a special economic zone, or a better example, Hong Kong, which is semi-autonomous. Now, some have interpreted this as another way of saying the farther you are from the meddling Communist Party, the better off you might be. Would you agree with this assessment? And if so, if Beijing makes an attempt to consolidate more power over its own economy, could that sabotage its growth?
Well, it is true that places like Shenzhen and Hong Kong are wealthy, but it is also true that Shanghai and Beijing, the seat of the government, Beijing is actually a pretty wealthy city on per capita income basis. And Shanghai, despite its cosmopolitanism, actually has a pretty large state sector presence. Most people don't know about that. I think the short answer to your question is that the state sector is never going to go away because they're tied directly to political assets. They're owned by the state. And if you're the Communist Party, you want to keep those state assets. It would be silly as the party themselves to get rid of those assets because they're a huge source of power. So I don't see that sector going away. And in fact, it's really only about 30% of the Chinese economy, the state sector. So the key here, but that's not matched with their actual political clout. They have bigger political clout because they monopolize industries, which means the barrier to entry is really high for a lot of sectors in China. So the only way, it seems to me, is to make sure that the private sector flourishes and so that it grows larger as a percentage of the overall economy. So that, by default, shrinks the state part much smaller. But the notion that it's going to sort of go away or just be privatized, that's just not going to happen.
There used to be some thought that economic growth would increase political reform and greater political liberties and so forth. How do you see the interaction between economic growth and political reform and increasing human rights and other aspects of liberty going forward in China?
Well, I think it's both economic growth and also probably proliferation of information technology and the internet, which we all know the Chinese government has been trying very hard to clamp down, but there's a limit to how much they can clamp down short of shutting it off completely, right? So I think, to answer your question, I do think that historically, if you looked at Chinese dynasties, it's always the revolutions have always come from the farmers and the rural population. But I actually do think that the middle class will be the agents of change in China. It's not going to be revolutionary. It's going to be gradual. And I think they are already demanding things because of the pollution issue. I mean, there's a lot of environmental activism happening in China right now at the grassroots level. There's a lot of NIMBY protests, not in my backyard protests now. So a lot of these projects that used to be kind of just put into China, there's a lot of political resistance now. So the process will be gradual, but I think to the extent China becomes, a billion people middle class, which is, again, unprecedented, that's potentially what it could be by 2030, a billion people in the middle class. That, to me, seems like a pretty sizable population that will demand change from the bottom up. And the key is whether the party state up top will be able to adapt to that or not.
Hi. My name is Gesser Baratin. I'm an international student from Mongolia at UAA. And thank you for your presentation.
I used to cover Mongolia. I was in Ulaanbaatar in the coldest winter in 25
years. Exactly. So
big mistake.
I found out. Yeah.
Too cold.
I was very excited to find out that you were a lead China and Mongolia analyst at the Eurasia Group that does the political research as well. And Mongolia has a relatively young democracy, and the economy has been growing steadily until the beginning of this decade. And in one of those years, it recorded the highest growth in economy. But currently, it's in a stage of economic crisis. So, how would you explain what happened in terms of change of the government, because we had an election for parliament last year and we're expecting another presidential election this year. And of course, Mongolian economy is nowhere to compare with Chinese, but what would be the best way of development of business and diplomatic relations between Mongolia and China?
Well, obviously, you know that Mongolia is in the unenviable position of being landlocked between Russia and China. That's just a reality that Mongolia has to deal with. On a practical level, in terms of how Mongolia could leverage the China relationship, I would say in the current moment, the best way to do it is probably to align, if Mongolia wants to have better relations with China, is to leverage President Xi Jinping's big One Belt, One Road initiative, which is essentially trying to recreate the 21st century Silk Road with a lot of financing for infrastructure, different investment projects, energy, commodities. So that's one way if Mongolia wants to participate in that. That's certainly something that the Chinese are very much focused on. And this has political backing all the way up to the top. So this is China's big grand vision for the 21st century of how to integrate economies from its west. So all the way from Central Asia, Mongolia, all the way up to Europe. And so to the extent that Mongolia can play a role in that, that would certainly make the Mongolian-China relationship probably a little bit better.
The chart you showed us that represented the losses of jobs in the United States and then the potential of conflict when you get that kind of tension between two powers, obviously implies some thoughtful actions. And what would your recommendations be, both to the U.S. and to China, to approach that problem in the most constructive way? I mean, could you give us some details around that?
That's a very good question. I would just make a couple points because I didn't talk too much about that last chart. There's obviously a lot of debate over that particular paper, especially within the economic community. What it doesn't show is how much technology has eroded jobs, which has done in a much more significant way, especially when it comes to manufacturing, than sort of any kind of trade with China. And in fact, there's been a lot of recent papers that come out basically said the job numbers are much higher than are higher in this paper than some of the other papers. But nonetheless, this has driven some political conversation around the country. And I would just say that politically, it's very hard to blame technology for anything bad. Technology is always a symbol of progress. And you can't vote on technology, but you can vote on trade, because trade is a policy issue, it's a political issue. So it's going to be hard to get Americans to thinking about technology versus trade and who's responsible for what. But we Americans should also realize that, because nobody actually read the paper clearly, it concludes that this shock is over. This is done. So essentially, we're relitigating the past about this. This is not the China shock, so to speak. It's basically a one-time event. There's not really any economies on the horizon that's really going to replicate what China did. It was just the last 10 to 15 years. So I think we need to think about how we perhaps did not anticipate the effect of globalization in terms of concentrated costs. The problem is that globalization, the benefits are very diffuse. People go to Walmart and they buy things there. They just want to make sure their prices are low. But they don't think about why that has to do with China or globalization. But concentrated losses in jobs, that does hurt local communities. So I think we should have done a better job probably in terms of thinking about how to retrain those workers, how to get them ready for the new economy, and how to really prepare some shock absorbers that we didn't really anticipate would come with this trade. In China, fortunately, has a lot of protections in place for their labor already. That's kind of a legacy of this kind of socialist planning economy. So in some sense, China in this regard is probably a little bit better prepared. And partly, those state-owned enterprises that's racking up all the debt, they're not letting those workers go because they are being protected from sort of economic dislocation. So I think if China and the U.S. could come somewhere into the middle, would be a pretty optimal situation. But I think we need to think just more about how we kind of make sure our labor force going forward is much more prepared for the 21st century economy, rather than thinking about, the China shock has come and gone. So we need to think about the future.
Sure. Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been listening to Damian Ma, author of the book In Line Behind a Billion People, How Scarcity Will Define China's Ascent in the Next Decade. This event was recorded on April 28th at an event sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council. I'm your host and producer for today's show, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.